In our last training together, I talked about how difficult it is to forgive. And part of the reason why it's so difficult is because we live in the world of myths around forgiving. So very quickly, just a recap of that to get us rolling. Remember that when you're forgiving, you're doing it for a particular reason. You forgive so that you are released, that you can move forward. It's not about the other person. It's not about the person you forgive. There might be some side benefit to that. For instance, if I forgive somebody and I can reestablish a relationship with them, there is a benefit to them. But I can forgive somebody and they have no idea that I've forgiven them. Maybe there's someone in my past that has really left some wounds and it has affected my life. And then I say one day, you know what? I'm going to forgive. I don't have to announce to that person that I'm going to forgive them. It doesn't even change anything about them. Maybe they've gone on with their life and they don't even know that anything's happened. Or maybe there is even some consequence, legal or otherwise, to what's happened between us. And that might not ever change. But guess what? I get to change. The biggest myth people have about forgiveness is that it's for the person you're forgiving. So they kind of hold it over them. They're like, I'm not going to forgive you. And a lot of times they're going, I'm not going to forgive you. And the other person's like, I don't care. I didn't do anything that needs to be forgiven. And then suddenly we're stuck, right? So we have to remember that your forgiveness is so that you are released from that. And that is a very important piece that we've got to hold on as we move through today's discussion. Because today's discussion, if you hold on to the fact that it is about the other person, you're going to keep saying, wait, why am I excusing them? But if you're realizing that you're trying to release yourself, then you can make the steps that are necessary as we talk today. So remember the big myths about that. One is it's about the other person. Two, it lets them off the hook. It does not let them off the hook. If there are consequences in place, you know, let's say that there's some legal action. I forgive you doesn't mean I'm removing the legal action. Let's say there's some relational consequence. I forgive you doesn't mean you're going to reestablish the relationship. You can say, I forgive you, but I'm not going to trust you. Trust is independent. It's separate from forgiving. It's not the same piece. You can choose to trust somebody without forgiving them. You can choose to forgive somebody without trusting them. You can apologize to somebody and they not forgive you and they never trust you again. So let's just say at the outset that there are four different components here that we want to make sure that we understand and keep them in their lane. There is asking for an apology, right? You're apologizing. Let's put it as there's an apology. There is forgiving. There is reconciliation. That's another one. And trust. Those are four different components and they are all separate. I know people who have reconciled and never forgiven, reconciled and never apologized, reconciled and never trusted. I know people who have trusted and never apologized, trusted and never forgiven. I also know people who have apologized with no forgiveness, no trust, and no reconciliation. People who have forgiven with no reconciliation and no trust. All of these are separate pieces, but we push them together and create this myth about what forgiveness is about rather than just seeing forgiveness as I am releasing myself from the hurt that someone or something caused to me so that I am no longer held hostage to it. That's going against the myth that we've been raised on about forgiveness. The second thing to remember is that while we are evolutionarily at an advantage by looking for every threat, it does not serve us well today. At one point, when we had nothing to do but to look for the threats to keep us alive, that made sense. But you and I, on a regular basis, are not really caught up into that. In fact, a lot of research now shows that we have two things going on at the same time. One, we're looking for threat. Two, we try to trust everyone we can. Because we have to figure out who is trustworthy, who's not. And so part of that process can keep us stuck if we're not clear that while there is an evolutionary advantage to looking for threats, that doesn't play in our advantage when we're working on this forgiveness piece. So the other piece I want to recap from last week is the pivotal point of deciding to forgive. Many people mistake deciding to forgive as the forgiving. I've talked to many people who's like, well, I forgave them for that. And I said, well, how did you forgive them? Well, I just said, I'm going to forgive you. But nothing changed. Nothing changed internally. They're still tied to that. I still see the pain. I still see them reacting to everything. So deciding is not the same as doing. If I decide to go on a trip, I haven't gone on the trip. If I decide to go to California, I haven't gone to California. I have to go there. I have to follow the process to get there. I have to get in my car, pack my car, follow the map, cross the mountains, cross the desert, and get there in order for me to have done it. The first step is just deciding I'm going to go. So remember that a lot of times we think that when we have decided to forgive, that we have forgiven, and that is simply not the case. It is only step one. It is a crucial step, but it's only step one. It will only get you to the beginning point, and that's where we are today to talk about the beginning point of this. So a couple of disclaimers. One is, if you really have some things that have hurt you in the past that you're really struggling on, forgive. What I'm going to say today is likely to arouse some feelings within you, and I want you to notice those feelings. If you're angry with me with what I say, if you somehow feel like I'm taking something from you, I want you to note that. Because one of the things that we do as humans oftentimes is we try to find a place to anchor our narrative. We all have a story. If you're familiar with the literary idea of the hero's journey, all of us have ourselves on a hero's journey. It's just kind of an archetypal place within us. And along the hero's journey, there's a story we tell to ourselves about where we came from and who we are. That story is not entirely factual. Understand that sometimes we have added to and clung on to pieces of stories that don't serve us. But we all have a story. And that narrative wraps us up and holds us down sometimes. I had a client one time that came into my office, a successful businessman, and I would not take that from him. But he sat in front of me and said, "I am a self-made man." And so what he was trying to do was justify all the spending he was doing, all the stuff he was, you know, he had multiple homes and houses and lots of toys, and he was trying to justify why that was okay. And I said, "Look, you don't have to justify your possessions to me. You don't have to do that, but you are not a self-made man." And he said, "I absolutely am. I have built the business and I make the money." And I said, "So you're not self-made, and let me prove it to you." I said, "First of all, where'd that business come from?" He said, "Well, I bought it from my father." And I said, "Exactly. There were a lot of other people who were working at that same place that did not have an opportunity to buy that business because it wasn't in the family. So you bought the business from him. First of all, he started. In fact, he didn't start it. His father-in-law started it. So now we're on a third generation of a business that's been, you know, helping this family. The second thing I said was, and are you the one who is making what you're selling? And are you selling it?" He said, "Well, no, I have an agreement with this company that's making this product." And so then we sell it. I said, "We sell it or your salespeople sell it?" He said, "Well, my salespeople sell it." I said, "Okay, so you're not self-made, right?" He said, "Well, I mean, you know, I hire them and I pay them to do it." I said, "Exactly. That's great. I'm glad you're employing those people, but you're not doing it yourself. Second thing is, you're not buying it from yourself." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "The customers are coming in and buying that product. They're making you too. In essence, there's a whole ecosystem that makes you, and yet you live and cling to this myth of being a self-made man." Now, I say that because we all have some myth in our head of who we are. And remember, myth isn't the same as saying it's a lie. It's just saying it's not entirely true. So we all have a myth of where we came from, and sometimes those myths, and this is where it matters back to this, come from what's happened to us, both in good and bad ways. You probably know people whose biggest identity feature is from some bad thing that happened. Whatever it is, maybe they survived a natural catastrophe, or maybe an accident or an illness, or maybe they came from an abusive family, or maybe they were attacked. I mean, there are lots of ways that people create that, and be aware of that. And it's true when we're in a marriage crisis. You know, I'm the one that got cheated on, right? That's one of those places where it's easy to gain some identity and dangerous at the same time. It doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It's just that when our identity gets bound into it, sometimes it keeps us stuck. So now we're about to talk about a process of unsticking, and that's where it can get sticky for you. So if I just want to kind of reiterate, this may stir some feelings in you, and understand that when they're stirring those feelings, when you're having those strong feelings, when you're angry with me, frustrated with me, disappointed with me, understand that that may be coming from a place where you're protecting that. Now, let me say that in a little different way. Sometimes we protect our hurts. Sometimes we even nurture our hurts. And in the process, we mythologize this process. So understand that I recognize there can be some difficulties of going through this process. And recognize that when those pop up, that that may be a moment of going, wow, I need to get some coaching on this, or I need to think about this. But don't discard the process of this. It's incredibly important. Okay, so step two of this process is to humanize and empathize. As I put it in my book, The Forgive Process, this is from enemy to empathy. That's how I talk about it. So let's talk for a minute about what that means. Because a lot of times when people say, you want me to empathize with them, what you really want me to do is excuse. Empathy and excuse are not the same. Yes, I know they start with the same letter, but they are not the same thing. Empathy comes from a different place. Understand that it comes from really a higher place within us. That word empathy comes to us from Greek. M-E-M is in Greek meant in, and pathos, in feeling. In other words, to be able to have feelings for the other person, to connect with the feeling level. If someone comes up and they start telling you of their struggles, and it's not that you feel bad for them. That would be like sympathy. Oh, bless your heart, sympathy. But empathy is understanding their emotional level. What's going on underneath the surface? That's empathy. And that's what we're trying to move towards, because one of the things that we often do is we forget empathy when we've been hurt. It's easy to give empathy. Someone comes up to you and they tell you about something that's happened to them, and you can feel the emotions of it. You know, you can feel the hurt, the pain, the sorrow, all of that from the other person. When they're telling you about a hurt that has happened to them, it's easy to have empathy when you have no connection. But what about when it's somebody who's hurt you? How do we move to empathy over that? So I consider myself to have come from a pretty intact family. I think I was very fortunate to have grown up in the family I grew up in. I had very loving parents who did the best they could to raise us to be loving, respectful people. And I think they did an exceptional job. And yet, one of the things I realized when my kids were born, and I found this to be true multiple times, that my kids were born, and as I'm raising my kids, I would literally call my parents and say, I am so sorry. I didn't realize how hard it was to do this. My parents had kids at about a similar stage as my wife and I, where we were in grad school. We were in grad school a lot longer than my parents were. But, you know, we were in that beginning stage of struggling, which is when a lot of people have kids. And so, you know, there were some times when I was like, man, it must have been hard for my parents to have done this, because they were really struggling too. And so I'd call and say, man, I'm so sorry. You know, I didn't realize how hard it was. And then when we had a second child, I'm like, man, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize, because, you know, what happens when you go from a child that gets all of your attention to dividing that attention out, there's no way that second child is going to get as much attention. I was the second child. I knew I didn't get as much attention. That was obvious, even from looking at photos and movies. And what I had to say is, I'm so sorry. I didn't know how hard it was to figure out how to multiply yourself across that. So what I'm saying is, sometimes we have events in life where we naturally shift to empathy, but sometimes we have to do a little soul searching. We have to get away from what we've created of somebody who's hurt us and move to something else. So empathy is looking at their emotional motivation for their actions. An excuse is letting them off the hook. of saying, well, it's, you know, they did that because of this, right? That's excusing their behavior. I'm not interested in excusing behavior as much as understanding that people are human at their core existence. And we often do what scientists call the attribution error. If you've read my information, part of what I talk about is that attribution error. The attribution error is simply this. If I do something wrong, if I hurt somebody, if I do something wrong, something that's hurtful, wrong, however you want to phrase that, if I do it, I say it's a mistake. If you do the exact same thing, I'll see it as character flaw. What I do, I see as, well, I just made a mistake. And I did the mistake because of what was going on around me. And, you know, I find the reasons why. So I say, well, it was because of this, right? So if you've ever had somebody that, you know, you're saying, hey, why did you do that? And they go, oh, it's because of this. And you're all upset that they're excusing themselves. Remember, that's what we do as humans. You and I do that too. That's the attribution error. So I'll go, oh, let me explain myself. And then once I explain myself, you'll see that it made perfect sense why I was doing that. But you do it, and it's a character flaw. There's something wrong with you. There's some reason that you're being hurtful that way. That's the attribution error, and we all make it. So one of the things I want you to keep in mind is what we know very clearly. Research shows it over and over, is that when we hurt somebody, and this means like when we actually do something hurtful, not like accidentally, like I can walk along and step on somebody's toes and I just didn't see their toes. But let's say I stomp on those toes, right? I want to hurt someone. When we hurt somebody like that, kind of an intentional thing, now we're going unintentional or intentional. The intentional stuff comes from our own hurts. Research shows that abusive people were abused. Let me say that we also know not to turn that around, that everyone abused does not abuse. We know that that is not actual, that just because you're abused doesn't mean you're going to be an abuser. What we do know, though, is that people who abuse were abused. People who do that had a hurt in their past. Now, let's just kind of take that down one more step and realize that many times people are acting out of their hurt, acting out of a less than helpful place in their own life. Some time ago, I was driving along, and we came on a dog that had been hit in the street. And I went over, and the poor dog had to go to the vet. So we were taking it to the vet, and I was wrapping the dog. And it was kind of cold. Good thing I had a jacket on. I was wrapping the dog in a blanket, and I cradled the dog. And so all I was doing was trying to help that dog get somewhere that it could help. And that dog latched onto my arm and bit into me. Now, I had a coat on, so I was safe, but it hurt. I mean, that was a strong bite. Dogs have a strong jaw, and that thing had grabbed hold of my arm and would not let go. Now, I was able to understand that what was really happening was the dog was hurt, and when I picked it up, it bit me out of pain. It held on to that bite out of pain. That dog was not going, I'm going to hurt you, as much as the dog was going, I am hurt and you're in my way. I see you as the cause. So understand that when dogs do that, guess what? Humans do too. When we are hurting, we often either intentionally or unintentionally hurt other people. So that's an avenue of understanding this and getting to a place of empathy. If we can reverse the attribution error and go, oh, mistake, mistake, we make mistakes. There are very few people who really intentionally, consciously, always are trying to hurt other people. They're called psychopaths or sociopaths. And by the way, what we also know is that they were wounded along the way too. Not excusing their behavior as much as explaining what's going on the inside. So we have an understanding of what's underneath that. We hurt out of pain. In a disconnected relationship, when somebody does something inappropriate, many times the hurting they do is trying to find relief from the pain they're having. Now, let me do a second piece, and there are two pieces I want to put together. One is that people do the best they can where they are, and that they do things for themselves primarily, not to other people. Both of those we hold as just kind of overall beliefs. I just hold them as core beliefs to myself, that people do the best they can given where they are. That doesn't mean that we're always doing our best, but we're doing the best we can given where we are right now. Might I do better tomorrow? Absolutely. Might I have done better last week than right now? Yes. But given where I am right now, I'm doing the best I can. Now, I hear people do that for themselves all the time. You know, they'll be doing something that's not the great, and they'll go, I'm doing the best I can, but we don't extend it to others. A path to empathy is just being able to say in the abstract, in the general, people are doing the best they can, given where they are. The second corollary to that is that people do things for themselves primarily, not to other people. You look around. Let's say that, I'm just going to take an example. People go in to rob a bank for the money they're going to get out of it, not to scare the people in there. That's not the intention. Their primary motivation, I want the money. This is across the board. People do things for themselves. Now, so let's say they have an affair. Many times I've heard a spouse say, I can't believe you did this to me. And in reality, the person primarily did it for themselves, trying to get a need met for themselves. Does that excuse the behavior? No, still inappropriate. Still damaging, still hurtful. But does it change how it feels like the direction of it? Yes, it does for me. And if you're having a reaction, remember I talked about that reaction you're having, tells you there's a place where you're anchoring to this. You're anchoring to what they did in a way that keeps you trapped. Now, the fact that I just said people do the best they can given where they are and they do things primarily for themselves, not to other people, does not create a carte blanche for their actions. You can still have consequences for actions even if you understand that they were doing it for themselves. If I decided to kill somebody because I was angry at them, there are still consequences, even if we realize it was because I was enraged by something that they had done, or I somehow thought it was to better my life. It doesn't matter. I still have done something. There are consequences to that. That is true relationally too. I do know people who can say, okay, we were in a disconnected relationship and you decided to cheat, and I am no longer willing to be in this relationship. There's a consequence of that. Or they can say, and it's going to take you a long time to, you know, regain my trust, or lots of other pieces to that. There still can be consequences to that. So understand that forgiving, separate from the consequences. Sometimes people ask me, so why do people do things? And my response is not always one they want to hear. My response is because it made sense. They go, it doesn't make any sense what they did. Oh, it makes sense to the person who did it. We all have a reason for our actions. Every action seems reasonable in the moment, even if it is not reasonable long term. In that moment, it seemed reasonable. Every one of us have a reason for what we do every day. Otherwise, we would do something different. Our reason begins to make it seem reasonable for that. So part of what we do in this process of forgiving is look for the empathy. Try to build a bridge that gets you away from what's happened and toward the person behind it, the empathy of that, to seeing them with empathetic eyes. One of the things I have couples do often is to keep a journal about their interactions. But what I have each person do is step back as being the reporter on the scene. And I suggest this in many coaching settings where people begin to objectify what's happening. We subjectify so much in our daily life that trying to be objective about it helps us step back a little bit. What does that mean? If I'm the reporter on the scene, I'm not trying to pick a side. I'm not trying to tell it from one person's side, but from an overview. When we overview, we tend to have a bigger understanding of that. So I often suggest that people be kind of the reporter on the scene. So let's say that somebody has a fight with a spouse. Then they leave and they pull out their journal and they talk about that fight. And instead of using the first person, talking about how, what the other person did to them and how they responded completely innocently and how the other person continued to push forward and all of the ways that it's generally formed, I ask them instead to think about it from an objective viewpoint. What led to this? What were the actions on both parties that led to this? What is the objective viewpoint? Not how the other person mistreated you or fought unfairly or insulted you, but how did you both interact? Sometimes it's interesting to me to have somebody have an argument in front of me and I ask them what happened and they tell me and they completely leave out their part of the argument. They're able to tell me all about what the other person did, but not much about what they did. So in this process of trying to objectify, they're taking a step back to see it from a distance. And that's part of what is important in this process of forgiving, of being able to see this whole process as being a little more abstract. To step back a little bit further and look at the struggling together as having a little bit more to it. And this is true for everywhere in life. As you see, as we step through in our next training, we step through the next couple of pieces, you're going to be really looking for how did you fit into that. But in this one, all I want you to basically be able to do is say, okay, they're human. Okay, they made a mistake. And I've personalized it. And maybe it would seem like it was done to you, but I want you to just realize that not done to you, but for them. So you look for their wounds in the process. Look for their wounds in the specific. Where are they hurt? So see the struggle kind of in the wider range of the fact that we struggle as humans and we hurt other people as humans. And then find some ways of talking more about that as the woundedness that, comes from. Okay, so that's step two, humanize as a way of empathizing with them. Move them from enemy to empathy. Right now, that can even be in the abstract of just being able to say, okay, they're human. Being able to be willing to say they're not the enemy, they're humans, and they are wounded creatures too, and they were working out of their pain in a way that made sense of them, even if it was hurtful to me. I've got to see the empathy, not to remove the pain from myself, but to empathize and see that there is another place there, that they become human. What often happens is that we don't give humanity to the people who hurt us. We somehow make them into supervillains. So this is rehumanizing that. Now, step three is the fact that part of what continues to power this whole process are our memories. And we got to release our memories. And this is where some people really struggle because our memories often are those anchors to who we think we are. Who would I be without that event in my life? If I'm not a survivor of this, or if I'm not the person hurt by that, who am I? That's what this stirs up. So recognize that now I'm stepping on some toes, and I recognize that and feel that and know that if you're feeling some frustration and anger over this, of why should you let that go, it's because you don't want to be held hostage to this anymore. Again, this is because you want to be free from it, not because it didn't happen, not because it didn't mean anything, but because you want to have your power back. That's the important part of this. So release the memories. Let's go back to one other very important thing. I also have a core belief that a thought is a thought. Now, sometimes I've said that and people think that that just means that thoughts are worthless. They are not, but they are thoughts. They are not reality. We have thoughts every day. We have tons of thoughts. In fact, that's what our mind does. It just creates thoughts. Some of them are useful. Some of them not so useful. Some of us point in a good direction, others point us in a bad direction. And part of our task is to know that the thoughts are there and we get to choose which ones we're going to spend time and energy on. I like that term, entertaining our thoughts, right? I've been entertaining this thought. Well, what do you mean entertain? I'm doing a little juggling act for this thought I'm having because it's just a thought. I don't have to give it any more credence. We all have thoughts that are destructive. We all have constructive thoughts. And the question is which one we're going to give the energy to. So a thought is a thought. And by the way, a memory is simply a thought from the past brought into the present. That doesn't mean it's worthless. It does mean it's a thought. We need to recognize that memories as thoughts that we've pulled into the present are imperfect. Our brain is not recording things as they happen, but as we interpret them as happening. If you know the study about witnesses, eyewitness reports are incredibly unreliable. If you're on the scene of an accident, you can interview everybody there and everybody will have a different viewpoint of what happened. Even down to the point of describing it physically, because our brains do not methodically record things like a video camera would. You've probably seen experiments where, you know, you're watching the bouncing basketball and the person comes out dressed up like an ape and you don't even know it because you're focused somewhere else. And yet it happened. Objectively, it happened. When you go back and look at it, you're like, oh, the video camera caught that, but I didn't. Because we are imperfect recorders of what happened. So what happened is not what we recall as having happened. Because we do that attribution error, the attribution of motivation, for instance, we assume when we know why somebody did it, and that's always a dangerous thing. My two nephews, when they were much younger, now they are much older and in their 20s, but when they were young boys, they got into a skirmish. And the older sibling started telling his father about how the younger sibling was doing it because he was mean, cruel, and out to hurt him. And the younger sibling, patting his chest and crying, said, "You don't know my heart. You don't know my heart." And I sat there and thought, my gosh, so true. We assume we know the heart of somebody who's hurt us, but we don't. And our thoughts assume that we see it correctly for what it is, but they don't. So part of what we try to recognize is that when we attribute the motivation for something, we're adding to the memory of it. We're re-encoding it. We're creating a narrative of it, not a recollection of it. Sometimes we forget. Sometimes we add to. Sometimes we do lots of different little twists with our memories, but they are not accurate. A few years back, my brother and I were sitting at the table. We're 18 months apart. We were telling some of the same stories, but I said, "I'm not sure you and I were at the same event." We're telling the same story about the same event, but it is from completely different recollections and completely different interpretations. And yet, we get those memories of those hurts that keep coming up. So first of all, we recognize that those memories are incomplete and have some inaccuracies to them. It doesn't mean that something didn't happen. It just means that recalling it and giving a lot of energy probably doesn't serve us very well. We spend a lot of time as humans with our capacity of recalling, acting as if that is helping us somehow, and many times the recalling we're doing is only harming us and holding us hostage, and that's what this is about, just recognizing that fact, because what we want to do is release the memories. It turns out that we as creatures, as humans, are the only creature that we're aware of that can consciously say, "Hey, you remember this event back there?" Or, "Hey, what do you think about this that happened back there?" We can recall that. If I said to you right now, "Hey, what happened last Christmas or New Year's?" You could probably tell me. If I said, "What happened the year before?" You might be able to tell me. If I asked you 2 years before, 3 years before, 4 years before, you're not going to be as accurate. And yet, you're probably going to be able to tell me something. If I ask you to tell me something about your childhood, you can go there. If I ask you to tell me about some painful event, you can do it. And here's the interesting thing. Because of the wiring in our brain, when we recall those events, we replicate the emotional charge we had at those events. Let me say that again. When we recall an event, our body acts as if we are in that event in the moment. Post-traumatic stress proves this. Somebody comes out of a traumatic event and there's a trigger and they are right back in that event, emotionally right back in the event, even recalling it back in that event. Emotionally, physical response, all of that. And we're all one big package. When you have an emotional response, it is followed by a physical response. It's the same thing. If I'm walking down the street and somebody scares me, I have an emotional response of fear, of threat, of defense, and my body is flooded with adrenaline getting ready for action. Same thing happens. If you walk down the street, this happened to me the other day. I was sitting there thinking about the night before I'd been at jiu-jitsu, and man, I lost bad. And I was recalling that, trying to go, okay, what would I do differently? You know, how could I have recovered that? How could I have moved away from it? And so I'm in my mind recollecting move by move what happened. And all of a sudden, I realized I was pulling on my dog's leash. My whole body had tensed up, and I was pulling on my dog's leash for no reason. And I had to remind myself that there was nothing that had happened. Now, I have some events in my life. I was attacked when I was a teenager a couple of times, people trying to actually kill me. And if I recall those events, which I don't do very often, I can feel my body slip back into a place of adrenaline and defensiveness. It happens automatically. It happens to you too. If you recall a fight with a spouse or a friend or a child or whatever, your body will tense up and go into defense mode as if it's happening right now. And that holds us and anchors that to the event. So when we do that, there is a process in our body. And here's our bigger thing. When we keep going, get back to the same thoughts, every time you go back to a thought, you deepen the groove to that thought. You make it easier for your mind to go back to that thought. You create. When I was several years back in the summer, we were at a beach house, and there had been a number of storms while we were there. And there, we were on this house that is right beside a sanded road. And down the middle of a sanded road was just a slight little indent. But every time it rained, it dug out that indention a little bit more. And every time it made the rain, the water go easier down into that groove. And the easier it went in the groove, the faster it dug down until it was a trench that you couldn't drive across. It was so deep. The same thing happens in your mind. It naturally creates a groove. When you keep going back to the same thought, you groove the thinking back to that thought. And then you fall into it easier and easier and easier and easier until that's just kind of the common place to go to. Soon as somebody says, hey, you know, tell me about yourself, back to the groove you go. And your body follows. Your body immediately starts reacting as if it's going on inside of you. Or it's happening outside of you. Not inside of you, but outside of you. Suddenly the inside thoughts are as if it's happening to you outside. Your body goes on alert. There are some ways you can regain control. So a lot of research has been done into the vagal nerve response, and it says that there are three different settings to that. There's a safe setting, there's an alert setting, and then there's an overwhelm setting. The safe setting means that you're not feeling any sense of threat. Everything feels safe. The on alert is when you're ready, you're in fight mode. And then when you're overwhelmed, it's the flight mode, the shutdown mode. And the difference between those two, bodily speaking, is that what that vagal nerve response is. But here is what is kind of the, if you will, the accelerant, the fear accelerant, or the fear suppressor. It is your breathing. So why is that important? Because your breathing is the one thing that you can take over in your body that happens automatically. We have a sympathetic, parasympathetic system. One happens automatically, the other we're choosing control over. And the breathing is the easiest. I mean, if I said, hey, slow down your heart rate, you'd have to do a lot of things. You'd sit down, you know, you'd concentrate on that, you'd try to calm yourself, but it'd be kind of difficult to do. If I said, hey, change your body temperature, you might go somewhere colder or warmer or do something external to that, but you'd have a hard time controlling it. if I said, hey, speed up your digestion, slow down your digestion, you might do something, you know, like that would frighten you or whatever to manage that, but it would be difficult. But if I said, slow down your breathing, you would. In fact, as I've been talking, you've been breathing without thought, probably. But now when I've recalled it to you, you realize you're breathing. So my question is, are you breathing from your chest or your diaphragm? Here's why that matters. When we are on alert, when we're ready for a fight, we breathe out of our chest, not out of our diaphragm. The simple fact is that our chest has ribs that are already protecting our lungs and our heart. But below our ribs are our kidneys and liver and digestive system, and all that stuff is below there. It's at threat in a fight. If somebody comes up and tries to hit my stomach, I tense my muscles up to protect my organs automatically. So when we are under attack, we start breathing through our chest to protect our digestive system. The problem is we can have a thought that triggers our sense of being under attack, and we do the same thing. And that begins to be a loop, an accelerant. If you want to have a panic attack, breathe through your chest. Refuse to breathe through your stomach and keep doing it. And breathe really fast and watch what happens to you. But then, and you may know this from when you maybe do a big sigh, you go, you'll notice that you breathe all the way down into your diaphragm when you do that. And you can feel your body just go, whew. Relax, because you just said to your brain, hey, everything's cool. So when you have a memory, put a hand on your stomach and just start breathing a little slower. One of the things that my teachers have taught me, people around this vagal nerve research say, is just be aware of your breathing. And if you're aware of your breathing, make sure it's through your belly, you'll naturally slow down. You'll take deeper breaths and deeper out breaths and in breaths. But I would like you to be a little more conscious of it. And what I want you to do is double your out breath from your in breath. Now, we all have different levels of our capacity of breathing. You know, some of us have pretty good lungs that can hold our breath and breathe slower. I know, I mean, I've done the research on myself to know that I've got pretty good lung capacity these days. And so my breathing is much different from other people around me. In fact, sometimes I'm sitting there in bed, I'm listening to my wife breathe, and she takes about two breaths for every one breath I take. So part of that, I'm a bigger person, bigger lungs, and part of it is, you know, I do a lot of exercise, so my VO2 max is pretty good. So I want you to kind of think through what numbers make sense to you. I use 4 count in, 8 breath out. So that's a 4 count as I'm breathing in, 8 count as I'm breathing out. Some people find 3 and 6, but basically you're looking for double your in-breath on your out-breath. When you do that through your diaphragm, so that if you put a hand on your belly and a hand on your chest, the hand on your chest should not move, the hand on your belly should be the one that goes up and down. You can lie down on the ground, lie down on a couch, lie down on a bed, figure out where that is, isolate your diaphragm, and then you got it. And then you're basically breathing in. 1, 2, 3, in. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, out. And you don't want to make yourself breathless, right? So if you're making yourself breathless, you need to shorten it a count and 2 counts on the out breath. But find somewhere that you're comfortable, twice the breath out as in. And what that does is it triggers your vagal nerve to go, oop, we're safe. No worries. So there's a 2-step process. Let's say that the memories of that event hit you, the one that you're trying to forgive, and it will because you're working on forgiving it. So it's going to pop up, and the memories of that come back to you. And as they wash over you, to remind yourself, okay, that's a thought. Is it a helpful thought or not? How much energy do I want to give it? But your body is already going, ooh, careful, careful, under attack. We're under threat. And then you shift over to your breathing. And as you do that, you begin to close off those grooves. It's going to take a while if you're well grooved into that thought process. If you automatically go right to that, the story of hurt, if the story of hurt has anchored you, you're going to go right back to it. That's okay. We're not trying to say it never happened. We're just trying to release how much it holds on you. So it pops up and you remind yourself, okay, I've already humanized that person. I got empathy for them. Doesn't excuse them. But I understand that they weren't out to hurt me. Okay, first step. Second step, now I'm not going to let those memories hold me tight. I'm going to fill in the grooves. Because when we don't keep following the grooves, our brain does something miraculous. It pairs off what we don't use. It's also dangerous, right? You learn stuff and you don't use it, it disappears from your process. So we use that to our advantage here. Those thoughts that we've been fueling and keeping that groove going, we just let it fill in. Let our brain pair off that groove. Let the synapses relax on that and let it go. That's a thought. First thing, that's a thought. Recognize, I'm not going to be anchored to that. It's not serving me. I'm not going to give it energy. And then you breathe through. What we now know is that when we don't add energy to the thoughts, and when we don't put ourselves into a fight-flight response, our body naturally calms down in about 90 seconds. So when you find yourself worked up for hours and hours, one of the things you realize, or even minutes and minutes, you know, half an hour, whatever it is, just realize if it's over 90 seconds, there's some piece of you that's working at holding on to that. If some thought comes to you and you go, oh, I'm not going to think about that, and you still find that you're all riled up about it after a couple of minutes, you still got a thought process going on about that. That's just a quick way of assessing that. You let them pass. You let them wash over you. You let it go through. It's going to pop up. You're going to decide not to, you know, give it a whole lot of energy. You're going to move through that. You're going to breathe through that, and your body's going to return to normal. The more you do that, the quicker it happens, the less often that becomes intrusive. Now, if you find yourself once again going, how dare you? You're taking away that from me. Realize that you've anchored to that story. And realize that does not serve your best purpose. Realize that we are limited by our stories unless we decide that we're not going to be, that we're not just the memories. We're not just those stories. We're more than that. Then we step to a higher place. So step one was to decide you're going to forgive. Second step, step two, is to empathize, to find a place of empathy for that person, to humanize them, and empathize is the way to do that. So we move from enemy to empathy. Step three is to release the memories as they come. Not release them forever because they'll come back, but release them as they come and breathe through. Next training, we'll tackle steps 4, 5, and 6.